feet up, we have a view of the rest of the island sloping east. Farhall is one of the highest points of elevation before Dragon's End, so the slopes descend in rolls and crags toward the lowlands from here. The smoke's coming from past the river source. If I had to guess, I'd say it came from Thornham, Rock's hometown in the near highlands. By the time Annie wakes up, the wind's shifted and the smoke has cleared. A brush fire, I tell myself, because she's melted cheese on scrambled eggs and peppered them with wild onion, and the look on her face when she kisses me still in her night shift is enough to blow smoke from my mind, too. If the dragon patrols that clutter the skies that day seem a little more frequent than days previous, they're still easy enough to evade in the shadow of the library. It's possible to convince myself that their presence over the highlands is routine security. The next morning there's another smoke column, this one from closer, probably within the far highlands. And though I can't tell exactly where, the folds of the mountains are too numerous to know for sure, my guess leaves me sick. "Is that smoke?" Annie asks, smelling it when she wakes. "Probably a brush fire." What use is there alarming her with an uncertainty? But the shadow lingers on her face as we make our way down to the travertine, only to find the dragons absent. The pool they've been lounging in since our arrival is empty. Annie catches my hand. "Look." She leads me back to the open terraces that overlook the surf. Ayla and Palor are in flight over the waves, climbing together, wing to wing, belly to belly, until the moment when they latch talons and fall. They pinwheel lazy, looping loops downward and disappear in the water with a splash. A mating dance. Annie is laughing, enchanted. "Guess Ayla's wings are better, but they shouldn't do that, they'll be seen." "Oh, hush," says Annie. They rise a second time, hook talons, cartwheel down, and a third. It's mesmerizing. A dizziness that I know is Palor's radiates from the back of my neck to my belly. Rise, cartwheel, splash. They're giddy with delight. And then they slither back into the travertine, without a glance at us. I take Annie's hand. "Did you know today's springtide?" She looks surprised, both that I remembered the holiday and that I care.
"Oh?"
"It's a good day for a hike. A springtide pilgrimage to Dragon's End. We'll hike together, and then I'll tell her about the wanted poster, about the smoke columns, and remind her, now that Ayla has healed, it's time to leave. It's time to tell her that the fairy tale is over."
Annie. The trail we take today, Lee calls Pilgrim's Pass. It follows the ridgeline of the escarpments from the Winterless Green all the way to Dragon's End. He packs a picnic in a knapsack and includes sprigs of herbs he refers to rather mysteriously as our offering. The hike takes most of the morning. Argos bounds ahead of us, sniffing the barrow mounds of the dragons of Lee's ancestors, the stone likenesses whose horned storm scourge faces stare out over the sea. As the island narrows to a point, the land gives way to sea on either side. Snowdrifts linger on the northern slope where the southern is already yellow with gorse. The scarf tying my hair blows loose within an hour and is carried away on the wind before I can snatch it. Lee takes my hand, laughing, and leads me on. It's noon when we reach the standing stones of Dragon's End. They've been exposed to the elements for so many centuries, the wind has rounded their northwest corners. Sheer cliffs end in a point where the North Sea meets the Medean, and behind us lies all of Kallipolis. We take seats under the springtide arch, and I crane my neck to look up at the shrine with a strange shiver. It's unearthly, but also familiar. Norcia has these everywhere, but I didn't know any survived in Kallipolis. Lee pulls out the ember box and our offerings. The rest were taken down during unification under Pytho Aurelian. Stormscourge House got a dispensation for Dragon's End. We pile stones in a high ring to shelter a fire, nestle the embers inside, and begin feeding it the herbs. Sage, rosemary, heather, for a long summer, long rains, and plentiful harvests. Didn't know Stormscourge House was so pagan.
It's not pagan, says Lee with surprising touchiness. It's tradition.
Oh. He scowls at my sarcasm, and I smile back at him. I'm privately imagining how nice it would be to do this with him every season's turn. These standing stones, this offering fire, this pilgrimage. Tradition. Another home word. I've started having those dreams again, I hear myself say. It isn't how I meant to tell him. It isn't what I need to tell him. But now I'm saying it. Lee's got a paper half pulled from his pocket, some sort of flyer. But when I speak, he pauses.
Oh?
You know, the ones where they're alive.
Oh,
says Lee, though we've never talked about this before. Those. He pushes the flyer, whatever it is, back in his pocket and gives the fire a bit of stirring with the poking stick. Those dreams are the worst kind. At least with the dreams where they die all over again, it gets better when you wake up. But the kind where they're alive? When you wake up, you wish you hadn't. I don't have to ask to know we've spent the last 10 years outgrowing the same kinds of nightmares. The thing is, I swallow, fixing my gaze on the fire because I know I shouldn't share this, but I've got the self-destructive urge to do it anyway. Sometimes it's different now. My mom's not there. I'm grown up. And there's a family. My face is burning in a way that has nothing to do with the sun or the fire. When I sneak a glance up at Lee's face, it's frozen. I know better than to add the rest. That the house in my new dream is the big house. That Lee's there, grown up too. That from this dream, I wake up feeling not gutted, but serenely hopeful. My words feel sticky. Do you ever think about what would have happened if we hadn't become guardians? It's the same question Duck once asked me. Lee's sitting very still.
Like, if our families hadn't died?
My face is hot. No, just if we'd been in Albans together, but there'd been no metals test. His brows are drawing together, like he doesn't quite understand what I'm getting at.
I don't know if that would have been a great life.
Maybe it would have been all right. We'd have had each other. There would have been no guardian vows. No state demanding we give up everything to serve it. I remember burying my mother better than I remember her. But after so many years thinking of her life as undesirable or even pitiable, I find myself imagining it differently now. I imagine how it must have been, her and Dad against the world, building a home and a life together. There must have been so much joy. The kind of joy I've tasted for the first time in my life this week. Lee's face softens as he understands.
Oh, he says.
For a moment, he seems to struggle with what to say next.
Of course we'd have had each other, but we wouldn't have Palor or Ayla. I think I'd miss them, wouldn't you?
After a week in Farhall, I'm scared to answer that. The dream feels like a betrayal of everything I've struggled to be these last 10 years. All at once, I feel colossally stupid for sharing any of this, and Lee's question makes it 100 times worse. Annie, are you... Is Ayla... all right? I tell my knees. She's about to lay. Lee says, oh. Like this explains everything. It was what I had intended to tell him in the first place. But his reaction isn't just insulting. It's wrong. It's not a one-way conduit. Maybe I am feeling these things because it's her time, but it's her time partly because I'm feeling these things. Grounded, full of joy. This is what I dream of. For the first time in my life, I'm healed enough to imagine a family in the future rather than the past. And he wants to dismiss that as a dragon spillover? My voice is small, my face still burning. You don't ever have dreams like that? Shut up, says a voice in my head that sounds like Chrissa. And I remember most people don't want to be interrogated about their views on having kids. But it's not like Lee and I have ever played by normal people's rules. We have our own. Lee shakes his head slowly. I don't want to have a family, Annie. I mean, I don't either now, but... I can't believe I'm saying this. I mean, ever. The severity in his voice leaves me blinking, as if I'd been walloped in the stomach. Because of our vows? As far as I'm concerned, the vows were called off with the restoration, and at this point I'm inclined to say good riddance. Lee lifts a shoulder, rubbing his forehead and shakes his head. It's different for me, the whole family thing. It's always been different for me. The other morning, I found books left open on the library table that weren't from the Basileian Wars. They were Lee's father's personal diaries. I didn't ask him about it, but I could tell from the dates he'd left them open to that he'd been searching for mention of Holbin. I looked for myself and found nothing. Lee's father, so loving to his own family, hadn't been bothered to record the horror he inflicted on mine. He was too busy recounting his ice wine harvests and his latest hunting trip. The thought of family is different for Lee, because of me. Because of how my memories have contaminated his. The thought prickles as I stare at my knees. Leon's storm scourge took so much from us. Even this. I mean, Lee's voice is hesitant. It's a bit of a moot point right now, isn't it? We can't just hide in Farhall for the rest of our lives playing house. We're dragon riders. Couldn't we? Is thick in my throat. I sound like a stupid peasant woman, don't I? Lee shakes his head, his face pained. Of course not. But he doesn't seem to have much more to add to that. He scratches his hair for a moment, staring at the fire, then pushes the silence aside very carefully. How long does she need? He's changing the subject. I hear myself swallow. A day? 2, maybe? Lee pats his knees and gets to his feet. Okay. We wait for her to lay. We remove the eggs. And then we make the flight to Norcia. He's sounding businesslike again. Like he's relieved to have found a way out of the conversation. It leaves me feeling empty. Remove them? It's how you control dragon breeding. You return them to the springs when you want hatchlings.
Ayla won't like that.
Well, we don't ask her.
Lee's tone is brusque.
We should be heading back.
He begins to pack our knapsack. Argos, returned from an exploration of the cliffs, bumps his muzzle against my hand, and I rub his shaggy back with unfeeling fingers. I reach for a topic to fight off the feeling of spoiling.
You had something you wanted to show me?
Later, Lee says. He begins to stomp out the offering fire, his back turned to me,
and the sharp scent of the burning herbs fills my nostrils.
I stuff my palms against my eyes to stop the tears.
Argos leans harder, tail thumping anxiously against the rock beside me.
When we set off up the path, Lee takes my hand and squeezes it.
I'm sorry.
He doesn't say for what.
But as we top the first crest of the high escarpments, I understand at last. On our way here, with our backs turned to the rest of Kallipolis, we didn't see it. Now our walk faces the island we left behind, and I can see everything. Columns of smoke rise from the highlands like a scene of battle. Not brush fires, blaze sites. I stop dead. My heart flutters like a dragon stalling, about to plummet on a stilled breeze. Has Lee seen this, or part of it?
He must have.
He's been waking up early and climbing the first stairs of Pilgrim's Pass with Nigel every morning.
This was what you were going to tell me.
Lee makes a noise that's not quite an affirmation.
I only saw two. This is more than I realized.
I pull my hand from his and set off for the big house as fast as I can without breaking into a run.
I've been an idiot. I should have seen this coming.
Ayla's wings have healed, but they haven't healed nearly fast enough. And in the meantime, I managed to entertain for a fantasy that lasted days, that we could stay here and forget our vows, that I could ever hope for the happiness I'm not allowed. I forswear all family and the comforts of hearth and progeny, that I be not torn from my purpose. In the lawn in front of the big house, a single dragon is waiting for us. A storm scourge. His rider dismounted and lounging against the garden wall with his arms folded, gazing at the setting sun as if hoping it will blind him. When he sees us coming down the trail, he bears a smile.
All that I am belongs to Kallipolis. By the wings of my dragon I will keep her. Let my will be her protection. Let my reason guide her to justice.
Hello, lovebirds, says Power Sewer-Eater.
27. The Summons. Lee. After a week of failing to talk sense into Annie, after a conversation at Dragon's End that took a turn I'm still rattled from, this intrusion is the last thing I want. Power Sewer-Eater stands in my courtyard, the sigil of the Restoration on his Grey Rider uniform, a characteristic smirk twisting his lips. His hair has been shaved so close as to make him look bald. Annie marches toward him with her fists balled as if he's what she's come down the hill expecting to find. My hand has gone to my summoner, chained in the old fashion around my neck. Why does Power always show up when he's least wanted? How did you find us here? I ask. That implies I haven't known you were here all along, Power sneers at me and speaks to Annie. Would you mind restraining your, lover, lord? I have trouble keeping track. Annie's hand reaches for mine, arresting it on the summoner. Lee, she murmurs, I don't trust him. But I do. For a moment, we stand frozen, her hand gripping mine over Palor's summoner, while Power smiles and watches. It's not that Annie hasn't made a convincing case for power. It's that I can't stand him. But even I am a little curious what he's about to say. I cede to Annie's grip. The summoner falls. She turns to Power. Would you like to come in for tea? Dragons above, has she lost her mind? If tea is a euphemism for something stronger, yes. Annie turns her back on both of us and leads the way into the house. In the drawing room, Power seats himself in the finest chair, what used to be my father's favorite, and looks around. Most of the windows on the main floor are still shuttered. We risked opening one that looks out over the sea. He curls two palms over the armrests and kicks a heel up over his knee. What a lovely little getaway you two have here. Annie's glance silences my retort. When she moves toward the liquor stand in the corner, Power's lip curls. I close my fingers around her wrist. Sit. I pour Basilean whiskey into three tumblers, set them on the marble-topped table between us, and take a seat beside Annie. Her knee bumps mine. Power looks down at our touching knees, then back at our faces with a widening smile that looks a little painful. He unfurls the wanted poster I've been attempting to show Annie ever since Nigel handed it to me, and hands it to her. Annie's shoulders curve over her lap as she reads. Let the bitch commander have the trial she deserves. She looks up, pale except for pinpricks of pink on her cheeks. You've seen this already. I nod. Power takes the poster back from her, sneering in my direction. I thought there might be a case of interference. The excuse for my delay sounds paltry in my head. You told me you didn't want this week to end. But that's private. Too private to share in front of Power. Do you have any idea what's been happening in this country since you went on your vacation? Power asks. We're not on vacation, Annie says. Ayla was injured. How unfortunate. Is she still? At Annie's silence, Power gives a twisted smile. School closures were just the beginning, he says. Now it's land. Ixion's been using the debt to Basileia as an excuse to set fire to all of Atreus's reforms. Serfs who were given land in the revolution are being reduced to tenants again and charged rent. Expensive city work permits are being issued that prevent peasants from leaving the fields. Annie has lowered her face into her hands. I summarize the shape of what I was already glimpsing on rounds before we fled. A return to feudalism by way of economic pressure. Power nods. Ixion hasn't redistributed feudal lands to the three families yet, but it's only a matter of time. In practice, if not in name, Kallipolans are on the verge of being returned to the status of serfs. It's the shadow that's been over our shoulders since the beginning. The world where someone like Annie belonged to the land she was born to, and that land belonged to someone like me. To tax, to punish, to eliminate, as her lord saw fit. With enough legal maneuvering and enough dragonfire to back it up, Ixion can bring all of that back. I'm chilled at the thought, but I'm guessing it's nothing to how it feels for Annie. Her voice is muffled through her fingers. What's your point with all this? Freyda's been cut off. Power sounds oddly breathless now. We found out at the League's spring summit that her jaunt to Kallipolis wasn't authorized. She left her brother at the altar, and now that her private allowance has run out, so has the grain. Ixion's in charge while she's gone to deal with whoever controls her purse-strings stateside, but what matters is she doesn't have backing. Annie's sitting up straighter, her eyes widening. Power nods. This is our opening. We're not facing down an empire. We're facing down one girl on the run from her dad, a massive dragon, and a purebred idiot. We need to act before Ixion tightens his grip. I assume you've seen the fires. Annie moistens her lips. Her glance darts to the window, surely thinking of the columns of smoke we just saw across the horizon. Blaze sites? Power nods. Ixians, but he's been blaming you. Thanks to an untimely slip from your oaf friend Griff, Ixion knows you're not in Norcia. Officially, the reason he's setting towns on fire is that he suspects they're aiding and abetting your escape. Coincidentally, the targeted towns contain those most resistant to paying rent for land they've owned since the revolution. Annie's voice is faint. Where? Power flicks an invisible speck of dirt from his fingernail. Thornham? Holbin? Her breath rattles. Holbin? It's where I'd go, too. Those people know how to rebuild. Don't worry, Power cocks an eyebrow at me with a kind of furious irony. Ixion didn't lock any doors. Next he'll spread to the lowlands, on and on, smothering dissent and using you and Lee as his excuse. Argos nudges Annie's knee, tail thumping the tea table, but she doesn't respond to him. She's frozen. Power sees his advantage and leans forward. You may have been telling yourself that Ixion's restoration is technically legitimate, thanks to some sort of assembly referendum under threat of dragonfire. But I stand by what our dearly departed First Protector wrote as a young and fiery lad. When a government ceases to protect its people, it becomes necessary to overthrow it. On the short list of people I wouldn't expect to be able to quote the Revolutionary Manifesto from memory, Power is pretty high. Annie's blinking rapidly, and Power only speaks when he's satisfied her eyes have filled. The way I see it, you've got two options. One is haul ass to Norcia and show yourself in the air as soon as possible. It might be enough to draw him off his scorched earth campaign. The dragon's healed now, right? Annie nods. So that's one option. Of course, Griff's aerial fleet isn't strong enough to retake Kallipolis, even with the exiled guardians thrown in, if Freyda's dragon is a lingering threat. And for all I know, Ixion might keep setting highland towns on fire just for fun. It does make them more likely to pay their rent. Annie's eyes are fixed on his face. The other option? Power holds her gaze as he reaches for his glass and knocks the whiskey back. I think you know what the other option is. For the moment where understanding passes between them that I don't share, I'm uncomfortably reminded of the month this winter when Annie and I barely spoke, and she relied on Power when I failed her. The falling out they had at the end of that period she's never discussed with me. But they've always had an understanding I couldn't penetrate. To spare the towns and Norcia, Annie asks now. Maybe. I think we can manage more than that. If they're discussing what I'm beginning to suspect they're discussing, their connection is even nuttier than I realized. You can't be suggesting... Power does not turn his head. Not talking to you, Lee. Annie's fingers curl over my knee. She speaks to Power. Go on. Power drums his fingers on his knees. Ixion is all but ascendant. The only thing standing between him and his formal crowning as Triarch Primus is your outstanding claim to the title of First Ridership. A bit of red tape Freyda seems fixated on for her own amusement. You have to be eliminated, and a trial is the easiest method. Annie is nodding slowly. The trial would be a farce, Power says, a spectacle, that doesn't matter. The point is, executions of the convicted have been taking place in the arena. Publicly. For the highest profile cases, Ixion delivers the dragon's punishment personally. Annie hums with sudden understanding. Ah! She gets to her feet, presses her hands to her sides, and walks to the window looking out over the sea. Her voice is as distant as the view. There's still the problem of the girl with the massive dragon, even if the purebred idiot can be accounted for. Well, maybe we'll get lucky and she won't come back from Vask. Annie shakes her head. Her voice is distant, like most of her mind is occupied calculating probabilities. Not a good enough guarantee. Lee's been studying some family history here, Stormscourge lore about Goliathans, how to take them out. We were planning to go to Norcia and start training the Guardians and Woad Riders there. Fine, says Power. Option A, you haul ass to Norcia. And leave Kallipolis to its fate? No. Norcia only needs one of us. Power looks between me and Annie. Her back is still turned. She stares out the window as if memorizing what she sees. I stare at her too. And then I get it. No, I say. You want to defeat Ixion, you fight him, you don't respond to his wanted ad. But when Annie turns back to me, she's smiling. Don't you get it, Lee? This is how I fight him.
Annie. I've been marveling, morning after morning, at the feeling of a good dream lingering when it should evaporate. I expected reality to crash in and the fantasy to shatter, and it didn't. But the dreams weren't the fantasy. This was. All of it. This house, these weeks, this stolen time with Lee. And Power's here to wake me. I was willfully delusional to think I could retire, could leave Kallipolis to its fate with Ixion at the helm, that he would somehow be a commensurate substitute to the regime that came before. Atreus's programs were critically flawed, but Ixion is a blight. The smoking hills he leaves in the highlands make clear he will not stop bullying this country until he gets what he wants. What he wants is me. And I'm done running. But I'll throw a little surprise in the mix. Lee's still catching up. You've been managing to ignore Ixion's challenges since he started posting them, he says, jabbing a finger at the flyer. And this is the one you're responding to? Yes. In fact, I look down at the charges listed and feel a serene sense of satisfaction. The mistake Ixion made from the start was that he aimed too high. I have no interest in proving myself as first rider. I don't think I deserve that title any more than he does. I let my city fall. But crimes against the people? High treason? These are titles I'm more than willing to let Kallipolis give me. Especially if that's what it takes to save it. The trial will draw him off. Turn his attention from Norcia, give you the cover you need to train our riders to take down Freyda. And when the time comes, I'll use the spectacle to my advantage. Lee's eyes are wide. Annie, forgive me for saying this, but a public trial wouldn't exactly play to your strengths. For a moment, I don't understand what he's getting at. And then I want to laugh. Sweet Lee, always trying to protect me. He thinks I'm hoping to exonerate myself at Ixion's trial. He's worried about my public speaking abilities. But I know I couldn't win a trial before the Kallipolins who hate me. I don't even know if I think I'd deserve to. Power looks between us, smirking. Personally, I think she's pretty articulate for a peasant. I have the urge to hit him. Not the time, Power. Lee, it isn't about the trial. The trial's rigged, Power tells Lee. A show trial. She'll be found guilty of whatever it is they come up with. Lee's looking between us like he's sure we're both losing it. Yeah, that's my point. So why would she ever? I answer. Because after I'm found guilty, Ixion takes me into the arena for my execution. And then you die, and then I summon. With what summoner? Lee shouts. Power lifts a finger. In case you've forgotten, your girlfriend's capable of summoning her dragon with her mind, through solid rock. When Lee's identity was found out, Power and Darius tried to beat us up in the nests after taking our summoners. It turned out Ayla and I didn't need a summoner. Judging by Lee's slack jaw, he'd forgotten. I nod in Power's direction and explain to Lee. And then I publicly defeat Ixion in the arena, and I'm still guilty of whatever they've charged me with. I'm still hated. But who cares? Because I've just finished that bastard in front of all of Kallipolis. I don't need their love to do my job. And this job I can do. Whether or not I'm first rider or deserving, I can do it guilty. All I need is this lowborn blood in my veins, the arena full, and Ayla saddled. I told myself it would be over after I got the Guardians out. I told Krissa I would do what it took to avoid a war we couldn't win. But it's not over until Ixion's finished. And this won't be a war. This won't involve the armies of great empires or the gambled lives of my countrymen. It will be me and him. It's time to take this where I should have taken it from the beginning. Dragonback. For the first time in a long time, when I imagine rising into the air with Ayla, I want it. And after that, I tell Lee, you take Freyda's Goliathan out with a fleet you've been training in Norcia, and we send her home to Varsk with our apologies for the inconvenience. Understanding flickers at last in his grey eyes. We can get them both, Lee. Two heads of the snake at once. We'd be left with a writhing headless snake after, and we'd have to make sure nothing terrible grew in its place. But I'm pretty sure Lee and I are a match for the handful of Grey Riders and Clovers that will vie for power in the vacuum. They're nothing compared with the weight of an invading empire, and now we know that empire would prefer to go home. The snake will writhe, but its heads won't multiply. There's one complication that remains with this plan. I turn to Power. Lee could still pose a problem. This flyer says he's wanted dead or alive, but I assume Ixion wants the former? Power grins. As do many of us. I lift my palm, and he rolls his eyes. Right. Lee's considered too much of a charismatic figure, even with the murder charge. As far as Ixion's concerned, Leo needs to be permanently eliminated. I'm nodding. So we fake the death. Otherwise, Lee getting away to Norcia will still be a potential destabilizer. My mind is working at a speed it hasn't since we arrived at Farhall. I'd forgotten how it felt to think like this. To whir. Parts clicking together, the problem working itself out in my hands. I know on instinct that the relevant variables are this setting, our history, and Ixion's penchant for cruelty. But when they finally lock into place, and I see the solution, it makes my heart constrict in my chest. I think I've got a way we can pull it off. I paint the picture with numb lips. Even Power doesn't seem to be able to think of a snide remark. By the time I'm done explaining, Lee's head is in his hands. I look from him to Power's grey face and feel fleeting uncertainty. You don't think Ixion would go for it? Power's swallow is thick. No, he would go for it. If we staged it right. If I suggested it. Especially if you acted upset. Lee's fingers clutch at his black hair. I bite my lip to bring the feeling back into it. I could manage that. And he'd have no reason to block the Traverton exit, not knowing we planned for this. We'd just need someone waiting in the cellar to retrieve Lee. Nigel, Lee murmurs into his lap. Right. And the dragons? You renounce, Power says,
"You'll have to brush up the old training. The Clovers need not suspect conspiracy, so renounce when they arrive. Can you use your mind thing to send Ayla in a specific direction?"
"I don't know. I've never tried."
"Practice. They need to fly to Norcia with a message explaining. Griff Suasparka can return with Palor to collect Lee when we're gone. How long do you need to prepare?"
When I realize Lee's glance in my direction is about Ayla and her eggs, my voice finally fails. He answers for me. "At least 2 days." He looks away and palms his eyes. Power acts like he doesn't notice, but even he has gone hoarse.
"Right. I can arrange it so the pickup happens on dawn of the 3rd day.
Power studies me for a moment longer, his shoulders ever so slightly sagging, and I realize, for all the bravado he's projected as he and I concocted this plan, it frightens him just as much as it frightens Lee. But shouldn't it? Power was there the first time I met Ixion. He heard what Ixion said to me. "I own you. And after this war, I will make sure you and all your stinking kind remember it. As far as Ixion is concerned, I have been and will always be nothing more than a serf who needs to be taught her place. But as Power has reminded me, the arena's my turf. It's Ixion's turn to learn. And death has not yet released me." 28. The Travertin. Annie. Power leaves once we're all able to recite the plan called, and after that we begin preparations. I expect Mr. Garth to ask more questions when we sit him down to go over the plan, but if he's puzzled, he doesn't show it. He anticipates the role we would ask of him and volunteers to do it.
"Be best to take Argos into town for the duration," he adds. "Got a niece who's very fond of him."
Next come the dragons. The manoeuvre we'll need, we haven't practiced since the earliest days of our training, known as renunciation, and usually only taught as a technical exercise. It's the reverse of summoning. A series of sharp whistles blown into the summoner in a specific staccato rhythm command the dragon to get as far from its rider as it can. Renunciation is rarely practiced, and more rarely needed. We take the dragons out into the pasture to practice. Ayla is grumpy, sluggish, her thoughts only of the hot springs she left behind. When she realizes she's being summoned from the warmth to train, her disgruntlement only grows. Her roosting is a wrench in the plan I'm not ready for.
"Ayla looks ready for mutiny."
"Well, we'll go for as long as she'll let us." We drill renunciations with summoners a few times, refreshing the dragon's memory. After the 3rd time, Ayla takes such a long time to return from the Travertin, I think she might have quit on us. When she finally returns, she glares at me, as if daring me to keep wasting her time, and I decide to move to the next stage. Renouncing with minds alone. When Ixion comes, we won't have the luxury of summoning whistles to issue commands the traditional way. Ayla and I are already spilled over, so I tiptoe along our connection, nudging my way, looking for some means to tell her what I want. Ayla's thoughts are consumed with the Travertin, its warm pools, how much she wants to return to them. I let the image of the caves fill my vision too.
"Go on."
Ayla cocks her head. Then with a disgruntled snort, she launches into the air and flaps her way back across the estate. Mr. Garth, breaking open the spring earth in the vegetable garden behind his cottage, straightens to watch her pass over, with a hand to shield his eyes, and Argos lets out a few sonorous barks. Can't she go faster? Lee's noticed, as I have, how slowly Ayla's flying today. At her rate right now, it wouldn't be hard for a well-paced skyfish to catch her. I say with more certainty than I feel. She'll be faster after she lays. Lee continues to frown up at the dragons. I add, it's not the renunciation I'm most worried about. Lee turns to look at me. She'll come back to you. It's going to be a long separation. Renunciation can lead to the permanent breaking of a bond between rider and dragon if they aren't reunited soon enough after. The dragons drift north like widowers. I've been suppressing horror at the possibility all day. My arms are folded as if to ward off the thought. Annie, come on. You and Ayla are inseparable. I nod, wishing he'd stop looking at me. For a moment, the mental wall I've been maintaining about what happens after Ixion arrives, when I'm parted from Ayla and Lee Ser Pallor, threatens to collapse. I shrug it away. Your turn now. Spillovers. Even for me, training with power, spillovers took weeks to master. It was too hard for me to let myself lose control. We had to resort to his calling me names before I got the hang of it. Lee, who keeps himself even more buttoned up, never shares minds with Pallor on principle. But for this plan to work, he'll need to make sure Pallor follows Ayla, which means Lee will need to spill over and do it on command. I study him, standing rigidly beside his dragon, fists clenched, looking more repressed than ever. So it helps to have an extremely strong emotion you can tap into. Think of something that makes you feel strongly. Maybe angry or upset? Pallor lets out a sudden growl, and Lee blinks at me. His pupils are dilated. Oh, that was fast. Yeah, I wonder what I have to be upset about right now. Right. He sends Pallor after Ayla, and then tosses his head, clearing it, his pupil shrinking as he extricates. I think they've got the hang of it. Back at the big house, I sit down for the first time to look over the annals and the Hermeneuta with Lee. The aversion I felt earlier in the week at the sight of work has vanished with the newfound purpose of our plan. Soon the central table of Farhall's library is covered with old, brittle diagrams. There are sketches of Goliathan anatomy, of vectors for javelins and soft scale points for entry, of formations for the island breeds opposing her. Last of all, Lee shows me the Hermeneuta. It's so delightful. I can't believe I've waited until now to look at it. A three-dimensional grid of thin wire and supported by a silver frame, the Hermeneuta is designed to stage scale models of aerial battle. Slender rods can be inserted according to coordinates along the vertical, horizontal, and linear planes, each with a small stone dragon affixed at its midpoint. Silver storm scourges, opal skyfish, agate Aurelians, even tiny sapphire Iskens and great jade Damians, not seen since the first Basileian War, and thrice as large as even the Damians, palm-sized onyx Goliathans. I weigh the two Goliathan figurines in my hands and wonder whether there's an error. One of these models is twice as big as the other. Lee jabs a finger in the direction of anatomy books I haven't read. Goliathans have pronounced sexual dimorphism. The larger one's the male. The extra horns are for subduing the female. I inspect the diagram he's pushed my way and shudder. The male looks like a winged sea urchin. I'm glad Palor doesn't have those. Lee's mouth curves. And I'm glad the Goliathan we're dealing with is female. We stage the female Goliathan at the center of the Hermeneuta and begin positioning the rods, simulating the formations of aerial battles in the third dimension. As Lee shows me, I let out a laugh of surprise at a sudden memory. All those years reminding Rock not to forget the third dimension. He would have benefited from this absolutely. I've worked out some drills based on what I think the formations are supposed to look like, but I want you to check me. It's work that plays to both our strengths. Remembering the third dimension is a particular knack of mine, and I'd forgotten until I sit down with these calculations and transpose them onto the Hermeneuta, the pure satisfaction I derive from mapping out a formation. Aerial tactics was always one of my favorite subjects. I look up from my work to find Lee watching me, smiling. There's the first rider I've been waiting for. The title has been a matter of some tension between us in the past, but I hear none of that in his tone now. Instead, it mostly makes me feel hot around the collar. You're not so bad yourself. Lee's had to make some adjustments to his drills based on how I correct the formations, but for the most part, what I notice as we go over his work is how instinctively he breaks complex maneuvers into discrete, digestible training segments. I suppose he's had practice from his years as Aurelian squadron leader, but I don't realize until we sit down like this to collaborate how much better Lee's instinct for teaching is than our drill master's ever was. He's even planned a contingency for the fact that there won't be a real-life Goliathan to practice on. Norcia's casts, which are Goliathan-sized, will serve as dummy Goliathans. Your drills are really good.
Thanks.
Lee rubs his forehead. It's grown late. We had to break to find candles and snacks.
The thing is, I'm still not sure any of these formations will do more than frustrate a dragon of Obazuth's size.
Palor and I had to get past her to find you. She barely felt his fire. Her hide's dense. That part I'm as stumped by as Lee is. You'll probably have to play it out to know how it works. The feeling I've gone without for so long I nearly welcome back, of study on the brink of exhaustion, with mastery on the horizon, returns in pressure beneath my eyes and an ache in my neck. When we break for sleep, Lee rubs the tendons in my shoulders till I nearly cry with relief. In the morning of the second day, Lee rises at dawn, kisses me on the forehead, and tells me he's going down into Harfast with Nigel to drop off Argos.
It shouldn't take the whole day.
Still half asleep, I struggle to remember if this was a part of the plan we discussed with Nigel yesterday.
Both of you? Why?
The nagging sense that Lee isn't telling me something fades as he pulls me closer. He kisses me. And, sleepy as I am, it lights my body with desire.
I've got a bit of unfinished business there. I'll be back in a few hours. You'll do what we discussed with the books.
Lee and Nigel take the old road south on horseback. Lee wears a hooded cloak to hide his face. I stand on the top step, my arms wrapped tight around a borrowed nightgown, and I watch them go. After, while my tea brews, there is a moment where I curl into my knees on the kitchen stool and spill ugly tears into my lap. It's only now that I realize how much I had wanted to spend this day in bed, in Lee's arms. But there's no use spending this last day, I can't help thinking of it as a last day, weeping. I drink my tea, dress, and carry a large empty saddlebag into the library. The annals from the Basileian Wars go first. The Hermeneuta, disassembled, goes second. And then, in the space left, I pack the scrolls I've read and loved in the last week, the fragments of poetry we've shared. Last of all, I unstick a portrait of Lee's family from its frame and stuff it, rolled up, into the bit of space on top. Then I take the saddlebag down to the cellar and tuck it in the passageway that leads down to the Traverton, where it will be waiting for Nigel and Lee. I can feel Ayla from here. She's not quite ready for me. So, instead of following the porous caves down to her, I leave the big house and go on the daily walk I had until today, taken with Lee. The route that takes me from one end of the Winterless Green to the other, along the barrow mounds at the top of the gorse-covered escarpments, through the vineyard and orchard below, already beginning to bud with green, and down the stairs off the cliff walk to the sea. Every breath and sight I take in, I memorize. When I've completed the loop, I enter the steaming white pools of the Traverton. There I find Ayla and Palor with the eggs.
Lee. I haven't ridden horseback in years since the perfunctory lessons they gave guardians at the beginning of our training to prepare us for riding dragonback. But after a day on Nigel's grey mare, Tilly, I have a fondness for the gentle, sure-footed creature, even if it feels strange to ride so firmly locked to the ground. We return from Harfest late in the afternoon. The big house is empty when I come in from the stables. I call Annie's name, and my voice echoes on stone. The words I read in a country courthouse seem to whisper in the empty air. Wife, wed, widow, heir. Futures that could have been. I told myself it was important to do it alone, without her. But for what's coming, there is only one set of vows that will matter, and she'll need all the strength they can give her. These forms, I told myself, were perfunctory. Not vows, but paperwork. Means to an end that in all likelihood will never be needed. Still, there was a moment in the courthouse when my heart constricted to imagine a world in which it could have been more than that. My father be damned, the rot of old memories desiccated by a horizon of blinding light. In that moment, I couldn't remember why I told her it was a future I never wanted. I couldn't remember why she wasn't here at my side, murmuring the words with me. Of course I wanted it. Of course I'll always want it. But Annie and I don't get the things we want. Alone in this house that has no future, the walls seem to shrink around me, tomb-like. I imagine flames, then force the image out. I go back outside, rubbing my temple. That's when I feel the tug. Palor's tug. It's so rare that it takes me a moment to recognize it. We spent much of our early years together practicing not tugging on each other. Then again, the drills yesterday broke that streak. Today, instead of pushing him out, I follow the tug toward the Travertine. He seems to be profoundly pleased about something. I find him submerged with Ayla in the hot spring. Annie is crouched at the edge, knee-deep in the steaming water, arms round her knees. In the center of the burbling fountain and the curled dragons sit three scaly dragon eggs. The biggest one is amber like Ayla, the next pale silver like Palor, and the smallest a mottled combination. They're each roughly the size of a human head. When Palor sees me, he lifts his snout a fraction, eyes flashing toward the eggs and nostrils flaring proudly. Look at you! Ayla gives me a haughty snort and I laugh. No training today, I promise. The one time my father's dragon laid, she didn't move from the springs for weeks before or after. The worry that presses with this thought, the needs that will come with the morning, I push aside, not now. Now is a time for rejoicing. Annie turns around. Her face is wet and ruddy from the steam. She won't let me take the eggs. I kick off my boots, roll my trousers, and place bare feet in the hot water beside her. It relaxes all the muscles sore from a day of riding at once. We don't need to take them just yet. Water is seeping through Annie's clothes. When I place a hand around the wet fabric at her waist, she takes a shuddering breath. The steam, the muggy happiness of the dragons, is clouding my head, and for once, I don't want it to be clear. I remove my tunic and slide into the water all the way. When I tug Annie's hand, she laughs in surprise, then sinks into the water beside me. Hold me? I take her into my arms. In the water, she is weightless, tiny, too small to let go